This is the Larry Mueller Show. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. It's the second Monday of the month, and that means that we're talking about technology. And today, we'll start off with a look at some devices that are designed to be simple to use. Our guest is Jesse LeGrew. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. We'll talk about how to make using your devices easier and find out how you can feel more comfortable using yours. Do you have some tips for teaching people to use technology? Have you taken a class that helped you learn about your device? Well, where did you take it? What other tech-related questions do you have? Join our conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Oh, welcome back, Jesse. It's been ages.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
It's good to see you, even if it is over an iPad. So we're talking about these devices that we use on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, every time I go up to the UP to visit my mom, I spend hours helping her with her smartphone and her tablet. And, you know, she's somebody who doesn't use technology every day. So it's really, really difficult for her. What kind of suggestions do you have for devices that are maybe simpler for people who don't have to use this every day?
Yeah, I think especially even when thinking about cell phones and tablets, there are a variety of options out there. Many of them don't work the same, and it can be a challenge just to learn one device, let alone two devices.
Yes.
One suggestion I have, and I think this is really for any technology, I think there's other things to consider, but for ease of use, utilizing the same organization or the same company to find a device can be helpful. If you do use an iPhone and you use an iPad, the look and feel of the device can be very similar. So you don't necessarily need to learn as much. There might be other considerations for using that, or maybe some other downsides. But from that usability perspective, if I just want to know how to turn it on, open a website, start a video chat, it looks the same when I move from an iPad to an iPhone, or potentially even from an Android tablet to an Android phone. But definitely, I think for consistency, Apple has been very good about keeping the consistency between different devices. So looking at the same organization, the same company you've already invested in can be really helpful, because hopefully things will work really well together. So you don't need to think as much about how these things work. But when you actually look at them, the buttons look similar. They have the same icons. They might have the same descriptions or text. So that can make things quite a bit easier, even though you still have to learn, you know, how does this one device still work?
Right. That's a really good tip. I hadn't really thought about that. And just so everybody knows, we are not sponsored by Apple or anything like that. It's just there's so many people out there that do have that particular brand of a device. But you're talking about Android. Just so people understand what devices, what products are considered Android? Because that gets a little confusing even for me. So what's that group?
Yeah, it's really anything using the Android operating system, which I think got very, very confusing, because there's a difference between what used to be years and years ago, something called Droid versus Android. Basically, if anything's running Android, it's an Android device. And that's a variety of different smartphones that are on the market, but also a variety of different tablets that are on the market. One of the interesting things with Android is each manufacturer or each reseller might customize that device. So even if you do have an Android cell phone, if you do have the same model, but it's from a different provider, let's say T-Mobile versus US Cellular versus, you know, name your other brand, the applications on the phone or the phone itself might look significantly different just because they support the phone differently. So in the end, the bare bones of that device, what everything's based on, is the same, but it might be very customized. And that does change from device to device, from manufacturer to manufacturer. So really anything with Android, but they can look very significantly different, even if it's on the same model of smartphone or even other devices.
Okay. So then are there specific devices that are built, designed, I should say, for people who really don't need a lot of bells and whistles, that just want it to do that one or two things that they really want it to do?
It's a great question. I think it's really rare these days. Most of the time when we do get a smartphone, and I know we're talking a lot about smartphones and tablets, but I think it's probably the devices we use most on a day-to-day basis. They used to be much more focused on, I can receive a phone call or I can text someone. Maybe at some point you had the option of being able to transfer images, maybe even video. But right now, they're so close to just the standard day-to-day computers that most of us also use. They're not dedicated to just those few different items that we need. You can pretty much do whatever you want with them. You can write a novel on one if you want to. You can use it to record notes or do potentially even video editing, audio editing. There are just, you know, the options are almost limitless in terms of what you can do with them. So when thinking about, I really only need to take a phone call, what can I do? Sometimes the easiest solution is, and you can still find them, you can get a non-smartphone. You can get a flip phone that simply has the features for calling and for texting. People still do use those devices for a variety of reasons. Privacy is one of them, but the complexity is another. If you just need to take phone calls and you don't need to worry about a lot of those extra items, because, you know, they do slow things down, they also tend to be more expensive. You can actually save a lot of that just by getting a device that's dedicated to that use. And I think that extends out to everything else. So if you're looking, for example, for a video conferencing device, you can still use a smartphone, you can use a laptop, but there are some dedicated devices solely for that purpose. In those cases, you might be spending a little bit more money, but you might get some additional benefit by not having to do everything on one device.
Okay. So if you are now working from home, and like many of us are, and you're doing a lot of Zoom, but you don't necessarily have a laptop that maybe can, that does a really good job with it, you can buy a device that's just for video conferencing.
You can do that. And there are definitely a lot of even organizations that are looking at this. They're looking at it for conference rooms. They're looking at it because the way people work tomorrow is going to be very different than it was a decade ago, where people might be physically present, but also might be remote. And so how do you enable people to kind of be in the same space without being in the same space? And so there are dedicated solutions to it. Most of them, I think, are very corporate driven, but you can get some that are useful for home. I think one that a lot of people have seen is the Facebook portal, for example. So if you use Facebook, you can get this dedicated device that allows you to have those phone calls or Facebook calls from person to person or between, you know, a group of people using a dedicated device. They might be only for a specific solution, like Facebook portal might only be for Facebook. I actually haven't looked it up to see if it uses other platforms, but you can do that. But I think a lot of people, especially if you don't have a computer, most people have a smartphone or a tablet. So even as you noted, you're using an iPad, you might just be using that other device for those meetings and for those calls. I actually, it's one of those nice things. If I have a problem with my computer, I always have a cell phone where I can usually do the same thing. So it does allow for some flexibility, but it's complicated because, you know, you have to maintain that other device. You have to know how to use it when the time comes. But if you really wanted to, you could find a dedicated device. It just gives you a different challenge of it. It might not look like your Android or your iPad. And so you need to learn how to set up and use that additional device as well. So like anything, there's kind of a pro and con.
Sure. And we're talking about basics here today. So when someone is listening and there's like, you know what, it's time for me to kind of, you know, get my feet wet with some of this stuff if I haven't, or maybe learn a little bit more about it, where's a good place to go to buy these devices? I would assume it's easier to do this in person than, say, going online to buy it.
Yeah, I especially with technology and knowing how, you know, it's going to work for you, I think it goes beyond technology. Without being able to see it or use it, It's really difficult to understand, is this really going to work for me? Am I going to know how to use it when the time comes? But also, do I have a resource to teach me if I really don't know how? So I do recommend, if you are able to, go to a store that has a display where you can look at the device, you can touch the device, because outside of, what platform it might be, some devices are simply more powerful than others. Maybe you need those features, maybe you don't. But a good way to find out is by actually using those devices. A great thing we have with technology these days is we have a lot of resources online to actually learn about these devices. So let's say somebody's unable to go to a store, they're unable to interact with the device they want to. There's a lot of great resources online, even by people who create this content regularly for training, but simple YouTube content of just end users that have used these devices, given feedback from their own families of, I've used this, this is how it's worked for me. And everyone's input's always going to be different. One thing I always like to do whenever I'm researching anything, I like to look at it from a variety of different perspectives, because sometimes there are things that people don't like that maybe don't matter as much to me, or for me, it's not really an issue. So I do like to get different takes on why people do or do not like a device and how it functions, because at least it helps inform me, this might be the route I want to go, or maybe I want to go to a different place. So there's lots of great research opportunities just online, freely available, which, I mean, it's just amazing. But it's also just that much more content to kind of sift through, to get those nuggets that really work for you.
And it's helpful to go to sites that maybe reflect who you are. So if you happen to be, maybe like we were talking about people over 65, so maybe go to ARP and they probably have all kinds of suggestions for you about where you can buy things or suggestions for recommendations or what have you. One of the things I always like to say is, hey, go to your library because, they're a font of wisdom. They don't just have books there. They have very smart people that can help you find things too, right?
Yep, and that's a great suggestion as well. And I was thinking of senior centers. If you have locations where there are a lot of people that get together that have similar questions, you might be able to find a lot of those great answers. And libraries is a really great resource. And Wisconsin actually has an online course available for computer skills. And so they actually did this, and you can see a little bit of this through the library system. But it is completely free computer skills training. From the Department of Public Instruction. And granted, this is online, so this may or may not work for everyone, but it might work for some people. And if not, you can always physically go to a location and you might be able to find some other opportunities. I know at least within Madison, even some of the public libraries are having in-person classes for that kind of information as well. So libraries are a great resource, community centers are a great resource. There's usually no shortage of ways to find help. Especially for instruction, community colleges, any kind of opportunities for continuing education or professional development, they'll tend to have options. Some may be free, some may you may have to pay for. But there's always an option out there to learn.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Mackenzie Crummy is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSouza is our technical director. We are talking tech with Jesse LeGrue today. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Are you having problems with a device or an app or whatever? Whatever is technology, we'll take a look at it today. Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We start off talking about trying to get technology, make it a little simple for some people, but we're taking other questions too. And let's talk to Louie in Oconto. Hi, Louie. What's your question?
Yes, hello. Happy New Year, Jill and Jesse, and all the listeners. My question, let's say a person received an external hard drive or an SSD, solid state drive, to back up his data on his computer, whether it be for don't have to worry about ransomware or maybe a natural disaster. But are there some things you can kind of point the newbie out, Jesse, on what to back up? Can you back up your whole, computer? Because I have a terabyte to deal with here. and just kind of go over some of the basics and where you can learn more, like you were just talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it does depend on kind of what computer you have. So most likely, most people will have either a Windows computer or they'll have a Mac OS computer. Both have built-in options for backups, which I highly recommend using. So if you're using a Mac, they have Time Machine. Turn it on, let it do all the work for you. Don't think about it. As long as you have enough space on that hard drive, it should help you quite a bit. The same thing with the Windows backup. If you can turn it on and not have to think about it, that's even better. When you do take a look at the external hard drive, ideally it's going to be bigger than the hard drive that you have in your computer, or at least it's going to have more space available than you need for your home computer, so you can back up everything. If you can back up everything, there are a few benefits you can get from it. If you have a computer die and you put in a new hard drive, it generally comes blank. There's no Windows, there's no Mac OS, there's no programs, there's no data. So you have to find a way how to get all of that information back onto your computer. Some of the built-in backup methods will actually allow you to restore everything, meaning you don't need to worry about reinstalling applications or your operating system and dealing with a lot of that hassle. So that can be really, really challenging. If you ever did have ransomware or some kind of virus, I actually recommend selectively restoring that data and actually installing Windows or Mac OS from scratch. There are ways to do that without needing to restore from that backup. But I highly recommend just using the built-in backup mechanisms that come with your operating system. A lot of times the external hard drives will come with their own backup utility, which can work really, really well just for backing up specific pieces of data. But if you are looking up to back, if you're looking to back up more and to try to restore your operating system or other applications, I do highly recommend using those other backup mechanisms, because it will save you a lot of time if you have enough storage space on that hard drive. If you don't have enough storage space in that hard drive, you need to really be picky about what you back up and find out what your important data is that you need to back up. The only way you can do that is really by reviewing all the data you have on your computer, which is no easy task. That might be something where those backup utilities can also help you as well. They'll generally tell you how much storage space is needed to back up a particular folder, which can help you get to that place where you need to be. That can be the same with Time Machine or Windows backup. So you don't need to necessarily back up everything. I just highly recommend doing it. So if you ever need to do that restore, you're in a better place. Like any computer, if you tend to have some kind of bad software, if you have malware or a virus, sometimes it backs that up too. So if you do have that kind of situation, before you restore, you will probably want to be more selective about what you put back onto your computer, because you could just end up putting that virus back onto your device and you run into the same situation all over again. And you did mention ransomware. So one thing I always recommend, you know, you do that backup all the time, you plug it into your device. When you don't need to back up your computer, unplug it. Because if you do have ransomware on your computer, your backup device is plugged in, it might actually encrypt your backup as well, which means it's not usable. Another recommendation I also have, and so there are layers of how paranoid you can be or how safe you want your data to be, store your data somewhere else. If you have a backup hard drive, if you're able to store it outside of where you live or where that primary computer sits, it will keep your backup more safe as well. So, you know, think of a fire. If you had a fire in your location, it could take out your backup as well. Once again, it may or may not be a concern for you, but it's something to think about if you did want to just make sure that backup's extremely safe. Safe deposit box are another great solution, because they can be pretty inexpensive and they're meant to really keep what's ever in there safe, even if there was some kind of issue with some kind of natural disaster or something else. So keep that backup hard drive safe. If it's not as big as your hard drive, you're going to need to be really picky. But just use those built-in backup programs with Windows or Mac OS. They also do have them with Linux. If you're in Windows, go to the control panel. It has just Windows backup. Just turn it on, set up your backup, follow the instructions, and it will go through step by step. Generally, I don't use the ones built into the hard drives, but sometimes they are useful if you don't have any other options. So that those are my recommendations for backups.
Okay. That's a much easier process than it used to be, isn't it, for backing up?
It is, and it's become much more, a lot easier for end users. I think one of the biggest improvements that I saw, even, you know, with using Windows most of the time, was actually Time Machine for Apple, because it was very easy to simply hit backup, to not think about it. And if you had to restore everything, you could easily do that.
Right.
Could take a little bit more time, but I think for the end user, if you really had ran into that situation, it made the process very easy, and you don't have to think about it, which is part of the goal.
Right. Absolutely. Thanks for that question, Louie. Let's go to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. You know, I was traveling last year, and then I heard that you have to have a smartphone to travel, like, next year. I hope it's not this year. But I do just have a flip phone because all I do is call. I do not text. I don't do anything else. And to have to buy a zillion-dollar phone and pay a ridiculous amount per month just to travel seems ridiculous.
Well, it's almost the case, isn't it, Jesse?
Yeah, and I mean, the only real recommendation I can have is get the simplest phone you can. Most of the time, I think you can actually get a very inexpensive smartphone. Many times it will come free with a plan. So unless you really want something above and beyond, usually you're able to get something pretty low cost, if not free, from your cell phone provider. But it can be very tricky with a lot of those, you know, options dwindling, especially if you do need to travel regularly. However you need to use your device, there might still be a variety of other options depending on what you need to use your phone for. And some of those could be, you can actually purchase temporary phones at your location for relatively inexpensive. You do have potentially a different phone number. You might be able to keep your phone number. It can get tricky, but you can find ways around that too, so that you don't need to you know, worry about getting a smartphone or another device. It's another thing to kind of worry about. But it always depends on what you need that phone for. If you need people to contact you, it's nice to have that same phone number, because you don't want to have to tell people, use this different phone if I'm in a different location. If you simply need to call out, actually using temporary phones may not be as challenging. And it actually could be potentially cost effective as well. So it does really depend on what you're looking for and what you need from your phone. I could go into a lot of other options, but they get much more complicated. You can hopefully get a relatively easy smartphone, something that's a little bit easier to use with less features, for pretty inexpensive, depending on where you do need to travel. Can be tricky, though.
Can be very tricky. And having traveled last year, I know so much information was on my phone, and it was wonderful to have that. You don't have to worry about the paper. You got updates right away. If anything was canceled, you're able to reschedule it. You know, as much of a pain as it can be, Nancy, and I understand exactly where you're coming from, definitely look into those options, because it's so nice to have that with you. And like Trina had just said, our engineer, there's lots of QR codes that you can use, you know, those little codes, those little boxes, even at restaurants. So something to think about, Nancy, and good luck and have fun traveling. Let's go next to Ellen in Madison. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm just I'm not up to speed on current technology trends, but I'm just curious. You know, there was a time when if you were purchasing a PC, that, you know, there were certain criteria. You know, the speed of the processor, or the amount of memory, I guess that was RAM. And I'm just wondering if those are the same criteria, if there's others now, and if having access to the cloud, which maybe individual users don't always do, would make a difference.
Yeah, it's a good question. Generally, even still today, there is that need for, you know, knowing how fast you want your computer, how much memory, hard drive space. Really looking at least most of the computers for, I'd say, just about every end user, at least for, you know, just standard day-to-day use, Usually CPU speed's not going to be as much of a concern today as it had been maybe 10 to 20 years ago. I always recommend get as much memory or RAM as you can, because that's where your software actually runs. The more you can do there, usually the faster your program's going, your faster your computer's going to run anyway. So most of the time your CPU, if you don't get the best, you're going to be okay, but always get a little bit more memory. And for hard drive space, that's a really tricky one, because we do like to store a lot of photos. Cell phones actually tend to be the storage location for that, which might be backing up to cloud resources. You might not need as much storage on your computer due to that. If you are synchronizing from your computer to a cloud resource or vice versa, you might need to store a copy of everything you have in the cloud just to make sure that it can stay synchronized or that you have another backup. I'd say in most cases, the basic hard drive storage you're going to get with most computers is probably okay for standard end users, at least for just normal pictures. One thing that can actually speed up your device, they will talk about two different kinds of hard drives. One is like an SSD or solid state, and the other is, they usually just call it like magnetic media or standard platter hard drives. Solid state or SSDs just tend to be a little bit faster. Cases they're coming with those anyway, but they can be a little bit faster. They might be more expensive if you need a lot of storage space, but if you get a little bit more memory and you have a solid state hard drive, the performance of your computer will be really well improved, so you can use it on a day-to-day basis. But most cases, if you get those the basic items that are going to come with that computer, you're probably going to be okay for day-to-day needs. Because even today, if you have a decent smartphone, you could probably do most of what you actually need to do on that smartphone, including, editing a document, changing something. Just, as we noted with travel, you could do most of the things you need to do on a cell phone. So with a computer, it really depends on kind of what your needs are. I'd say a lot of those defaults are going to be good, but I always do recommend get a little bit of extra RAM and get a solid state hard drive if you're able to.
Great. Well, thank you for that call, Ellen. And if you have a question, we have open lines. Jesse LeGrew, of course, is our guest today. He's information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Join in by calling 800-642-1234. And you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go back to the phone. Well, actually, you know what? Let's go to emails, because we've got some of those too. So Steve from Madison called, but he couldn't stay with us. Steve is wondering where he can go to find his computer, find out if his computer has been infected or has malware. So is there some way to find that out on his computer?
That's a good question. Depending on the type of computer you have, you may have antivirus software already installed, which you can use to run a scan of your computer. It at least would give you a better indication if it was infected or not. The downside is if it was really well infected, if it's something that's particularly nasty, you may not actually be able to see it. I would also recommend looking at a third-party service. You can use a variety of paid services from different computer support organizations. They could be larger organizations like Best Buy, or they might be smaller organizations that are local to Madison. But usually you can find a location that's going to at least take a look at the device to see if there's anything bad that's happening with it. If you do have a Windows computer, there is a built-in Windows Defender, which comes with Microsoft Windows, at least if it's a newer version of Windows, which you can run a scan with to see if there's anything unusual. And there are some online scanning utilities that will allow you to download a scanning agent and then scan your computer. I'd be careful of those without knowing exactly which one you're downloading, because you might download something bad instead of something that actually is meant to keep your computer safe. So I'd always probably fall to the side of caution and ask for some assistance from an expert. And actually take it to a store that might take a look at or do a checkup for you. And usually they have checkups that are relatively inexpensive that they can use to make sure your computer is safe. If you also did have backups of all of your information, another thing you could do is just play it safe yourself. make sure all your data is backed up, and reinstall your operating system on your computer, or use a factory reset that might come with the system. Sometimes those aren't foolproof, but if it's not an infection that might be particularly dangerous, you might be able to do that. Make sure your computer is clean, and then actually restore any data that you would want as well. So I have a few different options, but if you want to make completely certain, you can always get that third-party advice.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Chris emailed and said that her laptop does not have enough space for a system update. She's wondering what's the best way to offload things to create space, and how does she look up what is taking up space on the computer in the first place, and if it's photos or messages or what else?
Great question. And this will depend a little bit on whether it's Mac OS, Windows, Linux, what kind of computer it is. There are some great applications out there that are really meant to help you understand how much space you're using on your computer and where that data is. I think one I've used, and this might be a little bit more technical, it was called WinDirStat for Windows. But it's a program you can install, and it would tell you have this much storage in this folder. And if you open it, it'll tell you, here's how much storage you have in these subfolders. And you can keep on going down until you find out where all that data is stored. There are similar applications for Linux and Mac OS. So there are some free programs to help tell you where that data is. Usually it's actually going to be in your documents folder. It's going to be in your pictures. It's going to be in your videos. So you can do some guesses, and you'll probably guess pretty well in terms of where that data storage is. If it were me, I would look at if it's my computer or, you know, your hard drive for your Mac. If you usually right click on your documents folder and go to properties, it will tell you here's how much storage is being used. That'll probably give you a good indication. Yep, this is where most of my stuff is. Let me look in some of my subfolders to find those bigger files. And then, you know, depending on where you find those files, copy or move anything to an external hard drive if you have it. If you don't, I highly recommend getting one because you might be running out of options if you're out of space. And then hopefully you can perform those upgrades. Another option, which could be good for you, especially if you are running out of storage space, you might already need a backup hard drive or something to transfer things to. You could also take this opportunity, if available, to upgrade the size of your hard drive. That is not possible with all hardware. Some of that comes built in, so you can't actually change it. But if you're able to, you might be able to actually get a nice upgrade for your computer, give yourself a little bit more space, and it might actually improve a little bit of the performance of your computer as well. Computers don't run well when they're out of space. So anything you can do to free up some of that space is going to be really, really good. But I would actually look into the upgrade hard drive possibility, because then if you keep that old hard drive, you just have an automatic backup of everything at that point in time. That's one thing I'd look into to see if you can do it. And usually if you're able to, if you know the manufacturer of your computer and the model, you can usually look up online whether that upgrade is a possibility, and you can get some ideas on cost. The backing up to an external hard drive is going to be temporary, just because you're probably you might run out of storage again. But then you also have that data you might access regularly on a separate device, which is hard to use in a day-to-day basis. If you don't think you're going to use it a lot, great. Put it on an external hard drive, throw it on a shelf somewhere, and you know, you can do what you need to do. If you think you might need to use it quite a bit, see if you can do that hard drive upgrade if it's possible. If not, find a way to offload it. And actually those external hard drives, those backup utilities I was talking about, they can also help to tell you the same thing. Where is your data stored and how much space is that taking up? So if you do get an external hard drive, they might also have built-in software that can help you with a little bit of that as well. But Time Machine, I believe, and the Windows Backup Utility can give you similar information. So there's a lot of built-in utilities in there you can find out. But if you're able to, I think this would be a great opportunity for a hard drive upgrade. And if you don't have a solid state, you would be probably amazed by how better your computer will respond with that upgrade. So not only getting additional storage, but actually getting an improvement of performance for your computer.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And let's go to Cheryl in Berlin. Hi, Cheryl.
Hey. I got a Fitbit pedometer through my insurance company, And I don't have a modern cell phone. I have the jitterbug type phone, but I do have a computer, and I wanted to know if I could activate that using my computer.
Good question. Do you know, Jesse? I know you're frantically looking it up right now. I can tell.
I actually don't know, because I think for most of the Fitbits, or at least the ones I've used in the past, it did require a Bluetooth connection, and it required the Fitbit application to be installed. I do not know off the top of my head whether it's capable of using a standard desktop computer. I do believe you need to have that application on any kind of mobile device. It could be a cell phone. It could be a tablet. So if you are able to install that application and you do have a Bluetooth connection, you should be able to get that device to be configured and then start downloading and syncing data with Fitbit. I will see if I can find something else, but I think you're going to need that other device to help with that device setup.
I wonder, Jesse, could she use someone else's phone to do that?
You can, as long as they don't have a Fitbit.
Okay.
Because I believe there's probably a limitation on the devices you can have installed. And I think when I did it before, and this was a couple of years ago, I think I could only have one device associated with it.
Okay.
But that might have changed considering the amount of devices they're kind of re-releasing. There is a possibility, but it does look like, depending on the Fitbit that you have, if it has GPS installed, you might not actually need a smartphone for some tracking. But I have a feeling that a smartphone is going to be almost a necessity in this case. If you can borrow friends, the downside is it still won't be synchronizing that data, unless your friend is around you, so it can connect via Bluetooth. To put that data somewhere else in the Fitbit cloud, so you're able to track it and take a look at it.
Okay, great. Thanks for the call, Cheryl. We're talking about technology with Jesse LeGrew, an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. What questions do you have about your computer or smartphone? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us tomorrow at this time, and we'll talk about the research that's going on at UW-Green Bay. They're looking into new options for pain management that don't involve opioids. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about the benefits of exercise for cancer patients. That's Tuesday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. And right now, we're talking tech, and we have full lines. So let's go to Bonnie in Madison. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello.
Hi, Bonnie. What's your question?
Well, I thought of a second one now. I want to know how I can find out if my computers have solid-state drives. But the main question is, I was just told that there is an app you can put on your phone, and they thought it was called Verify, where you can add your passport, all your vaccinations, your driver's license, your global entry card, and it will fill out the form then from that app without having to sit down and go through everything at the airport, et cetera. Is he aware of any apps like this?
Jesse?
No, so I am not. I have not taken a look at the Verify app myself to see how you could use it. There are a lot of services that can do something similar. One thing I always recommend with any application, especially if you're downloading it with a smartphone, take a look at the reviews, and sometimes the notes can be really useful, especially when thinking about like passport data, driver's license data, if you do have social security numbers, any kind of sensitive information. I tend to be extra careful in reading the terms of service because you never quite know what they're going to be doing with that data. Sometimes there has been some bad application developers out there, and they have managed to publish applications that are not good. And so they end up stealing data or using it for other purposes, including installing malware on your phone. So I haven't used it myself. It sounds like a great option if it's available, and at least maintains the security of that data. I would just be a little bit cautious, especially if you're putting a lot of sensitive data into those applications. The solid state question, that's a great question. If it's a Mac, you can actually go to System Preferences. There's an Apple menu in the upper left-hand corner. Click on the Apple, and you can actually go to System Information or About, and you can get some information on the model. It might say solid state, it may not. Usually with the model number of your hard drive, however, you can Google it, and Google will tell you all the information you need to know about the solid state hard drive. If you do have Windows, they do have something called Computer Management. And that comes in your control panel, and you can take a look at the computer management, and they will have something called Device Manager that will tell you, this is the hard drive that you have. It's called disk drives. And once again, it'll give you usually a model number that's going to make absolutely no sense to you, but you can usually take that. You can put that into Google, and then Google will tell you, this is the kind of drive it is. And it'll usually tell you this is solid state or no, this is not solid state. So a couple of different ways. There's other ways on Linux, but usually that'll get you most of the way there.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Bonnie. And during the break, Jesse, you did find an answer for, was it Cheryl, with the Fitbit question?
Yeah, there is now an application, at least for Windows and Mac OS. It's called Fitbit Connect.
Okay.
And so it will allow you to set up your device. If you do have a laptop, you know, most laptops are going to come with Bluetooth. So the Fitbit still requires Bluetooth connectivity. If you do not have a laptop, there is a good chance you do not have Bluetooth, which means you might need to buy an extra adapter for Bluetooth. That being said, once you do it, you have it. And then you can set up your Fitbit and potentially use other Bluetooth devices. But it does require Bluetooth, and you can use a Windows or Mac OS computer to connect. And it did state Windows 10. So if you don't have Windows 10, it may not work.
Okay, sounds good. And speaking of Windows 10, we did get an email from Jean who said that they upgraded to Windows 11 from Windows 10. And she was wondering if she could delete all the old Windows 10 updates now.
It is very likely yes. It depends on where those updates are located. A lot of times with Windows, you'll usually see like a Windows old folder and something. It's usually something you can remove without any kind of issue. So I would say generally, yes, if there are old updates or there's stuff that was there from Windows 10, you should be able to delete it. To be extra cautious, I would actually probably Google that exact folder you're thinking of, because somebody else has probably asked the same question on the internet. Usually you're going to find a Reddit post or something else that's going to give you the answer. But it always depends what location that's in. Deleting the Windows folder, for example, is really, really bad. So don't do that. but if it's like a Windows.old folder and the upgrade was completely successful, things seem to be working well, generally that folder can be deleted without any issues.
Okay, great. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Phil in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Hi, Phil. What's up?
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about warranties. It seems like all the cell phones come with a one-year warranty, even if you're buying a $1,000 iPhone. Yet my $40 Android also has a one-year warranty. It seems like people with these expensive phones should be getting better warranties. Are they getting scammed?
Well, point of view on that one, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the, even a lot of computers too, desktops and laptops, the standard warranty is usually 1 year. You can usually purchase extended warranties, or they'll come with an additional warranty for an extra cost. That is the case. I believe Apple still sells AppleCare, which usually would extend that warranty for another 2 years. And I think those still also have the option additionally for an additional cost for accidental damage. So if you accidentally run it over or something else happens, you might be able to get that repaired as well under warranty. And you still might have to actually pay a cost to get that replacement device. But there are ways to get those additional warranties. It is still pretty standard to have the 1 year. With any warranty, whether it's a computer, a smartphone, or anything else, Do read the terms, what that warranty actually covers. Sometimes it does or does not cover accidental damage. It may cover replacing a hard drive for your computer, but many times it won't replace getting the data that you had from that previous hard drive. So you might not have that information. And that's one thing I've seen with a lot of laptops as well. You might have to ship your laptop back to actually get it repaired. And you might find out, oh yeah, we fixed your laptop. We put in a new hard drive and reinstalled whatever operating system. You lost all your data. So definitely review the warranty just to understand what might happen. And also always have backups because you just are never quite sure what's going to happen. Things do break, whether on purpose or on accident. So it's always good to have those backups. But one year is still pretty standard. And usually if you do have an issue, I think with a smartphone, at least speaking for myself, it's usually going to be something that's not covered because I dropped it or I did something that I shouldn't have. And usually those are not covered by that warranty anyway. So I can't say it's dramatically changed recently, but it is still pretty standard to have that 1 year limited warranty.
Okay. Thank you, Phil. Next up, we've got Nancy in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Well, here I am, an old gal. I used to have a telephone, two tin cans with a rope between us, you know, but that doesn't work
you
anymore.
You did not,
but this
Nancy.
Is not too far away. I have a landline AT&T phone here, and I have one in the basement, one in the porch, one in the kitchen, and one in the living room. So I don't, you know, wherever I am, there's a phone. But that's just my landline. But if I want to call long distance, because I have a daughter in Alaska and a son in Texas, then I got to pay extra money to a little company that charges me for long distance. What's a smart way to do this? I mean, I got phones all over, but and I don't want to have to carry one around all the time. Is there some way that I could keep my phones all over and still not have to pay about at least $50 a month just for plain calls? So maybe you got a smart answer for me.
Yeah, and maybe one of our listeners probably does. They probably know of some good plans out there that has low cost long distance for landlines.
Yeah, and that's the only thing I can kind of think of. If you want to use the existing phones that you have and you want to find a way to have it be a little bit more cost effective, the only solution I can think of without getting any other technology is to get a different provider for your cell phone service or your landline service if you're able to. I can think of a lot of other options. If you wanted to try to use a cell phone, if you tried to want to use other things like Skype or FaceTime or any of those solutions, but if you do want to use those phones you have, that's really the only thing I can think of is looking for a different provider to get your long distance service from.
Okay, well, if anybody has any ideas, please either email them or give us a call. And speaking of email, let's go back and cover a couple of these. Joanne from Appleton emailed, and she's getting email attachment that is labeled image 003.jpg. And Joanne wants to know, what is the best application to open those attachments? So it looks like it's just a JPEG, just a picture.
For the picture itself, if you're using Windows or Mac OS, the built-in application should function fine to open the files. Hopefully you did anticipate that email and you did anticipate that attachment, so you are verified that it's safe. If you verified that it's safe, you should in theory just be able to double-click on it and open it, and it should function. For the last 5 or 10 years, Windows or Mac OS should be able to open that right up without you needing to do any additional work. They just have built-in programs that open it. If you actually get an error message when you do try to open it, there might be something else wrong with your computer, actually, because really by default, those JPEG images, they should open. If you are using a Windows computer, you can also open up Microsoft Paint or another program and try to simply open the file manually. And you should be able to do the same thing with Preview or another application of Mac OS, but you shouldn't even need to worry about which program to open. You should just be able to double click and it should open for you. If it doesn't, you might just want to save it to your desktop and then try to double click and open it from there. If that is giving an issue, Maybe the file itself wasn't as safe as you thought it was, and it could actually be something else. There are other services you can use to scan those files as well. But if you don't know the sender and you don't know what the attachment is, the safer thing, in my opinion, would just not be to open it. So make sure it is safe.
Absolutely, because that's where all the nasty stuff lies, doesn't it? In those attachments.
Yes.
So if you don't know where it comes from, Joanne, just ignore it. Otherwise, use that preview on your email tab, because that works pretty well, doesn't it? It actually still stays in the email itself. Well, we're talking, taking your technology questions with Jesse LeGrew. He is an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. What tech questions do you have? Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this break for the news. We are talking about technology today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Jesse is an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He assists with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. What tech questions do you have? Unfortunately, right now, for you, if you haven't called in, our lines are filled, but you can always send an email. It's ideas@wpr.org. So let's go right back to those phones, Jesse. Up first, we have Greg in Madison. Hi, Greg. Greg, are you there?
Hello.
Yes. What's your question?
Well, we like streaming public radio.
Good for you.
On tablet and on cell phone. However, it quits on us after a while. So then we have to go in and restart it. So why is that happening?
When you say restart it, do you mean the actual app, or do you just have to?
No, I have to go back in and hit, play.
Play. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have that problem too, Jesse. Is it our app, or is it like a timeout kind of a thing?
It's a good question. I would normally lean on it's going to be a timeout where it thinks that you might not have interacted with it in quite a while and it just pauses by itself. Each app is a little different. So you might have a setting that you can change where it will never do that. But even as I've used other streaming like video services, every now and again, you'll get that reminder. Are you really still watching this? Because if you don't say yes, I'm just going to sit here at the screen and not do anything. So it could be a feature. Or it could be something else. Since it seems to happen with at least more than one person, I'd like to think it's a feature. But I would take a look to see if there are any settings that would allow you to change that behavior. That's probably the only thing I could recommend at the moment. I'm guessing it's probably not because you have another kind of device that's plugging into your phone, which I've seen with Bluetooth devices. So if you have like a stereo system in your car, or if you have headphones, every now and again, those will take over. And then all of a sudden you're wondering, well, why can't I hear everything? And then somebody else tells you, oh, by the way, I'm hearing whatever you're trying to listen to. That can happen. But I would actually take a look at the app itself just to see what settings might be there. The fact that you actually can see and you have to hit the play button does make me think it's the app that's actually pausing it. So it might simply be a timeout that you can set. I would take a look at that. If the app doesn't have a setting for it, I would actually recommend, usually you can supply comments for the application, and then developers can also take a look. And each app is a little bit different. So definitely take a look to see if that's the case.
Greg, that happened to me this morning, so I know people. So I'm going to talk to the people about that today and ask them if it's something on our app or it's something I can do on my phone. So we'll get to the bottom of that. But thanks for listening to WPR. We appreciate it. Let's go next to Mark in Menominee. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon. Jay, I wonder, we hear a lot about the cloud. And I wonder if Jesse could explain what the cloud is, where is it located, how secure is the cloud, and our data or information that's placed there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the thing that that's always stuck with me, which is really true, the cloud is simply somebody else's computer. So when you look at your own laptop, your own desktop, you're storing it on a physical device you can touch, that you can hold. When you're storing things in the cloud, you're actually storing them somewhere else. They're not necessarily on your computer anymore. Someone else has a computer and a hard drive that's actually storing your information. We have used a lot of systems like that in the past. Whenever you navigate to a website, we may or may not call it the cloud, but it's still someone else's computer. You're actually accessing a service that you personally don't own or physically can't touch. So when I think about the cloud, that's what I think of. We do talk about private and public cloud. And that's really private cloud is really the data centers we thought of traditionally. Public cloud is a lot of those services we use on a day-to-day basis, like Amazon, Apple, any streaming service we just talked about, they're utilizing a lot of those cloud services. So basically, your data is just somewhere else. Now, how secure is it? That can really depend. There's a lot of mechanisms that help to keep your data safe. It could be your username and password that's used to access your information. If you have a weak password, it might not be as protected as you'd like it to be. If you have a really strong password, if you also have multi-factor authentication turned on, that might help to protect it from someone else trying to access your data. However, on the other side, if that data is not encrypted at rest, meaning that no one else can see it outside of you, whoever you're hosting that information with might be able to read your data. They also might be able to do something with it you might not want them to. For that, it really depends. I always like to look at terms and services. I'm sure everyone really loves to. It's the thing that you look forward to when you're signing up for that next thing. But a lot of times it will tell you, this is how we're using your data. This is how it's shared or how it's not shared. And that can be really important when you do, you know, kind of broach in a relationship with a new product, because they're likely going to be storing something for you and they're going to be processing that data in a variety of different ways. I think most of us know when we've gotten emails out of the blue, which we have no idea how they happened. Sometimes that's because your contact information might get resold by different vendors, or they might find your information somewhere else. So those are items to keep in mind. It can be extremely secure. It can be extremely insecure. I always like to think about the things that I can do to better improve that security. And for me, it's making sure I have strong passwords, that I have multi-factor authentication enabled, and that if I'm storing sensitive data that I'm concerned anyone else has access to, I might do a little bit of extra reading to understand what they might be doing with that data. I might look at user reviews. If it's storing a social security number, for example, I might not actually trust it unless it is affiliated with like a governmental institution. Everyone has security challenges, including the government, so it doesn't mean that it's completely safe. But at least I understand the controls and the regulations that are put on different organizations. So the cloud is just anyone else storing your data. It's just someone else's computer. And the security can really range depending on what you're using from. And if you do invest in any of those services, the more sensitive your data is, probably the more you want to take a look at other controls that are on your side that you can help to control who has access or how they can use that information.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mark. Let's go on to Eileen in Madison. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
What do you have for us
today?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Hi. I'm calling about the woman who called about her landline phones and AT&T. And I had exactly the same problem. I have two phones on my main floor and one on my basement. And I did not have long-distance service, but I bought a prepaid AT&T long-distance card and with 1,000 minutes on it. And you can keep your AT&T service and still have this a calling card, and it's inexpensive and usable whenever you need it, and it just lasts for a long time. So I hope that helps her. It was exactly the same thing that happened to me. So I thought I would just call in and tell you.
Well, great, Eileen. Thank you. I kind of forgot about those. Good idea, right, Jesse?
Yeah, and those are, and that's actually a great idea for a lot of services. If you can buy those chunks of resources ahead of time, you can usually save a lot of money. And the AT&T prepaid cards, you can get in a variety of places, either online or in a variety of stores. So that's a great option. Thank you for calling in about that.
Yeah, definitely, Eileen. And for Nancy and Grafton, any of your relatives that are listening, what a great present to give you for birthdays or Mother's Day or whatever, because that's something you're definitely going to use. Next up, we've got Tom in Buffalo County. Hi, Tom. What can we help you with?
Yes, hello. I'm looking, I want to get an SSD for my Dell Optiplex 990. And I'm looking out here at my specifications, and it under hard drives options, 2.5-inch hard drives, up to 500 gigabytes, 7,200 RPM, SATA 3.0 gigabyte per second. What does that mean?
Yeah, so another good question. So the 2.5-inch is literally just a measurement of the size of the physical drive. The fact that it says 2.5-inch actually does tell me it's a hard drive that can be removed and can be replaced. When you do get a solid state hard drive, they're usually going to be that 2.5-inch, what they call form factor. And that 2.5-inch is what you're going to be getting for your solid state drive. Usually the 2.5-inch drives are actually what have traditionally come in laptops. So if you look at a desktop, traditionally, they're actually going to have bigger hard drives. They're going to have 3.5-inch hard drives. Laptops are actually going to have 2.5-inch hard drives. So it's a little bit smaller, might be for a laptop. But since you have a desktop, and I haven't taken a look for that specific model, you might actually have one of the desktops that actually is smaller. So to actually fit it in your computer, they used a laptop hard drive because it was easier than using one of the bigger ones. So basically, that's what that is. The 3.0 at the end is just the speed. SATA 3, I think you can also get up to 6.0. So you might be able to get a little bit faster. That may or may not be supported by your computer. But if you get a faster hard drive, it will still work with your system. It may just use that 3.0 gigabit per second speed. So hopefully that helps. Basically, it's a smaller hard drive. When you do take a look at it, if you do find it, you can actually measure it. Take out a ruler. That's where the 2.5-inch comes from. But you're basically using a laptop hard drive in your desktop, and it may or may not be solid state. But it looks like when you get a solid state hard drive, it's usually going to come in the exact same size. It's going to look extremely similar. It's just going to be a lot lighter if you currently don't have a solid state drive.
Great. Thanks for that question. And thanks for that answer, Jesse. I'm totally impressed. It sounded like Greek to me. Thank you, Tom. If you've got a question, we do have a couple of open lines, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella. What's your comment? You have a comment for us.
Yes, I do. I also am calling in regards to, I believe it's Nancy with the landlines.
Yes.
We have a landline. We don't have cell phones. Excuse me. We used to have service with AT&T, and we got the phone cards. They are about 3.5 cents a minute, and you can recharge them, which is one option. You do have to punch in a bunch of numbers,
right,
in order to do them, but they do work. And also, we live in Sturgeon Bay, and our internet service was provided through AT&T, and then the company that was providing our internet ended that, and we had to find another source for internet. And Sturgeon Bay was wired years ago for cable TV by
Charter,
right? And Charter has changed to Spectrum, and we went to Spectrum, and we now get internet, email, and phone service, which includes unlimited free long distance calling for one flat rate for the month.
Okay, well, thank you, Stella. That's definitely an option if Nancy wants to get internet, although having talked to her before, I don't think she uses it, but you never can tell. So another option for people. And let's go back to the emails. We've got Kathleen from Milwaukee, and she emailed that she's wondering, what is the most secure platform, like, I think she means more like app, for like Zoom or Google Meets to virtually visit with friends and family? She's concerned about unwanted visitors or algorithms intruding in the visit. What can users do with a device to improve privacy settings? So maybe she does mean platform.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there's a variety of ways to answer that question. I think there's not necessarily any one platform that's going to be better than another. It's usually the settings that you can turn on or turn off with any of those platforms. One of those is actually turning off guests. So if you haven't invited somebody specifically to a meeting, they won't be allowed in. And you can see this in a variety of different platforms. Some of them also have what they call a waiting room, where you can have a meeting and people basically sit in the waiting room until you allow them into your meeting. And then, you know, they can't interrupt if they were trying to do it in the middle or do something else. So having that approval process, I think, can be really, really useful. And if you're able to turn off those guest settings. So I think whether you're using, Zoom, Google Meets, if you're using Facebook, I mean, there's so many different ways to do it today. If you have the ability to control who can enter the room and how you can turn on or off guest access or room approvals, if they have those features, great. I think those are going to work for you really, really well. If they don't have those features, I think that's where you might want to look somewhere else, because you do want to avoid somebody else just jumping into a meeting and either recording, grabbing screenshots, or just doing something that we really just don't want to see in any meeting that we're a part of. We've heard of Zoom bombing and all this stuff for a year or two, maybe beyond, but definitely with a lot of people being more remote, it got a little bit more interesting and a lot more popular. So make sure you are using those settings to control who can enter or exit, and just turn off guest access. Turning off guest access can be really useful. It might mean you need to invite people in a different way, which can be a little bit more challenging, but it will get around that issue of either needing to manually approve people as they enter or having those guests just kind of pop in uninvited.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question, Kathleen. Excellent one. We're all using that these days. Frank in Racine has a question. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Guest was saying that there are very, very attractive prices for smartphones. What I get every year, I can only get it for 1 year, then I have to renew it for another year. I have an Android LG track phone, smartphone, and costs me, the prices vary depending where I buy it. Like Home Shopping Network sometimes has a better price, but say roughly about $100 with prepaid data of voice and texting on there. Where can I get a better deal than that?
That is a good question. Now, in terms of the prepaid phone plan, there's a lot of different plans you can get from. It depends on the phone. But you can actually purchase the phone. I'm just looking up online a little bit. You can purchase the device itself from a variety of locations. And actually purchasing the phone and the plan separately might save you money. I would actually take a look at seeing what plan your phone uses today and whether you can simply buy the minutes and if you can use it on a different phone that you didn't get from that provider. Hopefully, in many cases, you're able to use it, but you actually might save a little bit of money just by buying the device and the plan separate. One thing I have seen with a variety of different plans, either for cell phones or for what they call VoIP, voice over IP, you can actually kind of purchase those lines and get interesting deals and use the devices a little bit differently. So I'd actually consider just purchasing them separately, because I can actually, at least online, it looks like I can buy the phone for relatively cheap, maybe between $20 and $50. So if you're able to get the phone separate and then add the minutes or pair to that service afterward, you might be able to save yourself a little bit.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Janet from Madison called, but she couldn't stay with us. She said that she also experiences a break in streaming when we were talking earlier. But for her, it's when she goes from Wi-Fi to cellular data, and there's always a break in the streaming. And that's obviously true in some circumstances. Not mine, but yeah, that can work, right? That can happen, Jesse.
Yeah, it depends on, especially when using streaming services, they kind of work in a couple different ways. You know, I'm used to actually listening to podcasts, which are downloaded, not really streamed in the same way. So as long as it downloads enough, you're okay. But if it's live, there's really nothing to download until it exists. So if it's actively downloading the data and the app doesn't know, oh, I moved from this and I have to use a different service, it may not gracefully fail over to that other item. So that is very, very likely.
Okay. And quickly in our last couple of minutes here, Dan from Duluth emailed, and he wants recommendations for disabling a device for good after a security breach. 2 minutes.
Well, so when I think of disable, I think of it's not going to be used again.
Yeah.
So when I think of do not use again, I take out the hard drive and I destroy it, or even destroy the entire device. The idea whenever you get rid of devices is you don't allow anyone to get any information from it, because it's likely something you want to protect or keep safe. So I would usually use a drill press or a variety of other things, destroy the hard drive. And you might actually be able to allow and donate the device to be used as long as that hard drive doesn't come with it. So you might find a way to actually get rid of the device while maintaining the safety of any of the data that was previously on that device.
So you could always take it out, take the hard drive out. You could put a new hard drive in, right? I mean, is that safe?
Yeah, and usually that's the case with a lot of the, if you're donating it especially, one thing to keep in mind, some of the newer devices, you just can't do that.
Oh, really?
The devices are, they're soldered in. The hard drive is something you cannot remove anymore. That's the same with memory. And that's why right now, especially when buying a new computer, it's really important to consider, if I think I might need a little bit more memory or a little bit more storage in a couple of years, get it today, because you might not actually be able to upgrade it. And so then you find out, oh, I actually would need to get a different device if I wanted to get more storage or more memory. So definitely that's something to keep in mind when getting a new device. Get those resources today, because you don't want to have to buy a new device, you know, a couple of years in the future.
Wow, that's good to know. I had no idea that that could happen. What's the reason behind that, Jesse? I mean, it's just so you buy a new one?
Well, that could be part of it, but mm-hmm. you might also get some resource benefits. You might get some additional speed by the way they're manufacturing those devices. But actually, the devices, since they're all built in together in solid state, they fail less often. When you don't have moving parts, you can get a lot of benefit from it. There's a lot of conversation about that in terms of the pros and cons.
I'll bet there is. Well, thank you so much, Jesse. Always fun having you with us. We've been talking to Jesse LeGru, an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. We're going to talk about new research on pain management and also the benefits of exercise when you're fighting cancer. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.